At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
This is the Friends Fister Debating Society. I'm Gaius. Germanicus is here. And we're in Londinium. We're going to the theater. There's going to be a mock battle tonight. The centurions have promised us a surprise. Wooden swords, a lot of recruits running around, a lot of teenagers pretending to be centurions. The retired centurions here have great fun teaching their skills to the young men, the boys, who then want to join a legion. It's recruiting. It's smart. And their children all want to join as well, because when your father's a retired centurion, you have weight in the army. You're the son of a centurion. It matters a great deal. However, we're going to turn to something that I've just realized after having read a biography of James I called The Mirror of Great Britain by a Cambridge historian, Claire Jackson. In 1607 and 1608, James is just new at being the King of England. Remember, Elizabeth dies in 1603, in March of 1603. And James is her inheritor. It's a little distant. He's the grandson of a sister of Henry VIII. All of Henry VIII's wives came to no heir in 1603. Elizabeth is the end of the line. Elizabeth, having never met James, the sixth of Scotland, he was made the king of Scotland when he was, I think, 13 months old. His mother, Mary, Queen of Scots, couldn't have the crown, and she either had her husband murdered or someone murdered him for her. And so she was obliged to depose, that means give up her claim on the title, and they gave it to the 13-month-old who survived, James I. Very intellectual young king, many languages, very well read, wrote poetry, went to the theater. Shakespeare wrote for him, for heaven's sakes. There's a very good case that Macbeth, Lear, and Antony and Cleopatra are all written for the king to reflect the gunpowder plot of 1605. Remember the 5th of November. But I'm going to get to the part that is most impressive to me is that my education said the founding fathers were in the 18th century. I have reason to doubt it after reading a biography of James I. 1607, the Spanish and the Portuguese have cut up the New World thanks to the Pope. The Portuguese get everything east of, Spanish get everything west of. They mean to claim everything. From the Arctic Circle to the, well, they don't even know there is an Arctic Circle. From the top of North America to the bottom, they're guessing because the maps are terrible. But that's what they claim. And it's the Spanish Empire. It's the Holy Roman Empire. It's very powerful. Remember the Armada? It's theirs. In addition, there's no one interested in giving anything to this sort of wormy little country at the edge of Europe called England. Well, here comes James I. They crown him. They say he's James I. He's got Henry, an heir, who's heir apparent. Henry dies young at 18, but nobody knows that yet. He's got Elizabeth, whom he's going to marry to the Palatinate in Europe, the Protestant lords that turn into the Thirty Years' War. And he's got Charles, the younger one. Charles will become king and have his head cut off eventually. But that's what the Stuarts have, the first functioning family in the crown, I think, in several hundred years. James accepts the Spanish ambassador, and the Spanish ambassador said, Your Majesty, perhaps you don't know that there are these invasions in our territory, in this part of the New World. And he points to a map, and he's vaguely pointing to the Chesapeake Bay. And the king says, I don't know anything about it. It's private business. None of my affair. It's not the crown. We're not there. Oh, yes, these fellows, they came to me. They wanted a charter. They paid me. They say they're going to pay in tobacco. I think smoking's a bad habit. I discourage it in my people. What else could I do for you? That's it. Germanicus, isn't, don't you love how simple it is? If he said, oh, forgive me, ambassador, tell the emperor I didn't know about this. I'll enforce it. There will be no more trouble in this big bay. That's the end of America, Michael. That's it. Done.
Well, I mean, just to give this some strategic context, his response was opaquely professional. I mean, he did not provoke. He did not promise. And he did not pander. Instead, he basically said, oh, unlike my predecessor, Elizabeth, who fought Spain for 20 years, and that war only came to an end right before James's accession. He had something of a threat there on Spain, and Spain had its own quite real concerns about the English in the New World, because after all, during that long war, all sorts of places like Nombre de Dios and a lot of places on the so-called Spanish Main had been pillaged. And of course, the great assault on Lisbon, Cadiz, towns in Spain, still lingered strongly in Spanish memory. So I don't think there was any real desire by either side to get serious here. But, the Spanish would come to rue the outcome, namely the colonization of the eastern seaboard of North America, because those colonies were constantly attacking either the French to the north or the Spanish in the Floridas, plural. And that would get very serious by the 18th century, and of course led to a series of wars between Spain and Britain, in which Spain actually held its own very well. But the truth is that James I was a cagey guy. And he, by creating the divine right of kings, he essentially set up the disaster that befell his son.
Yes. In 1618, James has dinner with a man named Yardley, Yeardley, an alternative spelling of Yardley, who is knowledgeable of the Virginia colony, the Jamestown colony. Jamestown has failed, but there are about 10,000 people who have now moved into the area. About 2,000 are still alive. The death rate is horrendous. Plus, the Indians are difficult, the natives. But they have dinner together, and James says, what is it that you need? Well, Your Majesty, we're struggling along. We need you to accept tobacco, because we can pay in tobacco. And the king he's an anti-smoker fanatic. Germanicus, I mean, just what do you do with this? It's the 17th century. You want to say, are you kidding? You know how much money there is in that? Have you ever heard of sugar? We got that too. Okay. So he says, well, do you need anything from me? And Yardley goes, yes, Your Majesty, we need permission. We need everybody to know that there's work for them. We need as many of your parishioners, your congregation as possible. And the king says, okay, fine. That's a good idea. I like having my realm extend into the New World. And that's 1618. What is that? A little more than 400 years ago. And so I'm not saying he went out of his way. He didn't pay for things. He didn't have much money. Parliament wouldn't give him money. He was always struggling to come up with a way of getting revenue, raise taxes, or give me he would have enjoyed tariffs.
He had plenty of money, but he lavished money on his retainers who fawned on him, especially the pretty boys. And
well,
he was a real spendthrift on all the wrong places.
And he gave permission to the Virginia colony. He gave a charter that said you can develop anything from Philadelphia to Newfoundland. He gave that charter out. He sold it. I don't have a paragraph two here. Paragraph one is, that's the founding father right there. Everything that happens in the 18th century doesn't happen except for him giving permission. to the colonists who come wave after wave for the next 150 years?
Well, the light management, as it were, of the colonies really is what led to our rebellion against Britain, ultimately, because by 1700, all of the colonies were essentially self-governing at that point. And they had royal governors, but I mean, the legislatures, the assemblies were independent. And in many ways, the English Civil War helped to, by establishing the dominance of Parliament over the monarchy, that kind of relationship extended ipso facto to the colonies. So the colonies, all 13 of them, had little miniature mirrors of what had happened to Britain during the Civil War. And so Americans grew up in the 18th century believing in the supremacy of their assemblies and not of obviously the king or even Parliament, because the thinking was, well, Parliament doesn't include us, British citizens, as part of their deliberation, and we have, as a kind of mirror of British society, we have our little kings, the royal governors, but they are subservient in some higher sense to the deliberations of the assemblies. So it was all figured.
I don't want to press this too far. I just find it entertaining as heck that maybe James I's picture should be on the $100 bill. Maybe.
He helped. He is an unappreciated king who's typically in the recent past, you know, the last 50-100 years or more, is seen as the guy who patronized Shakespeare to some extent, or Shakespeare wrote while he was king, and then he's seen as the father of Charles I, the walking disaster. But the truth of the matter is that you've brought out here is that he essentially, although he didn't realize this, obviously, he set the course for the development, not just of modern Britain, but of the United States as well, by essentially pursuing the doctrine of divine right and setting Britain on a course where there would be a final showdown between Parliament and the king. And of course, that was the showdown that America went through with Britain in the later 18th century. So in a sense, he was the father of two countries.
Right. Great Britain is the mother country, and James I is the father. And George Washington would acknowledge it. So would Ben Franklin, in their way.
Yeah.
Germanicus is Machiavellius. Gaius is John Baxter. We're in Londinium. We're going on to a mock battle. I'm not sure which one they're going to stage for us, Germanicus. We'll be surprised. Apparently, there's a game out tonight. We have to guess the battle they're recreating. The centurions are leaving early. We'll be along, guys. We got to sacrifice to Augustus on our way. This is the Friends of History Debating Society, live from Londinium. I'm John Baxter.